when you get to a hospital, what do? Do you reject the African nurses, the Asian doctors and all that? Or do you say you don't want to be treated by anybody who's an immigrant here? Of course they don't. At that point, they suddenly realise that humanity comes first.
Jeremy Corbyn, welcome to How the Light Gets In.
Wonderful to be here. The river behind us, the rain above, what more could we want?
Throughout your long and distinguished political career, you've made a point of sticking to political principles that you've held from a young age. Your critics have argued that all politicians, both left and right, have to compromise principles in order to win votes. Where would you draw the line between compromise and sticking to principle in politics?
Well, if you can't stick to the principles you believe in, of peace, justice, inclusion, social change, sustainability, and that allow those principles or ensure those principles form your day-to-day political activity and policy making, then what is the point? Are you just electing a politician in the heritage, if you like, of Edmund Burke, where you know better than everybody that elected you and you just go off and do whatever you believe to be right? You then get sucked away from the very people that have put you there. Democracy has to be accountable, you have to be representative, and we have a system that is designed to be the very opposite. And so I've had a very interesting time. I've been in Parliament since 1983, when I was quite young. I was 34 then, and I've always felt that the parliamentary system is at one level fascinating because of its history, its intricacies and so on, and the origins of it, which are actually quite radical, but also the way in which it quite deliberately is designed to suck elected politicians away from their electorate into a cooperation with the status quo and the forces that guide the status quo. So I think you have to think about these things quite seriously if you're first elected to Parliament. I sometimes get approached by people who say, what do I need to do to get into Parliament? And I always say, why? Why do you want to get into Parliament? And they don't have an answer. So I say, well, until you've got an answer to that question, you shouldn't be in Parliament.
And did you get more satisfaction, would you say, from being more of a moderating voice on the back benches of politics, or more satisfaction from being leader of the Labour Party and running from the front?
They're both challenges, and they're both different challenges. Speaking out on the back benches in Parliament on things you believe in, and having an enormous amount of pressure to be quiet is not an easy position. And I remember when I was first elected, talking to Tam Liel, who's passed on now, sadly, and he said, Jeremy, never be afraid of being unpopular and never be afraid of boring the House with your views. He was quite a character, was Tam. And I remember in the 80s onwards, I was trying to encourage a peace process in Ireland, which, if you're to get a peace process anyway, you've got to speak to all sides. And that meant talking to the Republicans and the Republican movement. And I got the most enormous amount of kickback, both from the media and in particular from the Parliamentary Labour Party. Very heavy. Just being told in terms, shut up, stop saying anything. And then when the issue of, I don't know if you know about it particularly, the issue of the Guildford Four, these were four young people who were wrongly and grotesquely accused of setting off a bomb in a pub in Guildford in 1974, which they absolutely did not do, four young Irish people. And the family of one of them had lived in my constituency, came to see me and described the whole case, and this, what they said, was a travesty of justice. So I said, leave all the papers with me and I'll read them, which I did. And I'll come back to you, which I did. And I said, well, I think there is a travesty of justice here. Let's get started. The amount of abuse I received for saying that this man, this case, it was Paul Hill, one of the four, is innocent, has got to be changed. And so we mounted a campaign alongside the Birmingham Six, and eventually they were released from prison. So it was an amazing experience. But the abuse I received taught me a lot of things about the power of the establishment. There are many, many other occasions. Becoming leader of the party was different because I became the leader in circumstances where the Labour Party membership and supporters had seen the austerity at the end of the Blair-Brown government, seen what the coalition government had done, and then felt that the Labour official offer in the 2015 election was simply no different. There were differences, but the overall impression was it wasn't sufficiently different, like we're carrying on with austerity, wage freezes and so on. And so the left in the party, Socialist Campaign Group, discussed it, put me forward as a candidate. We had to struggle might and main to get the 35 MPs to nominate me, which we eventually did with 1 minute to spare. We got the last nomination in. So I was a candidate, and my very small team said, what do we do now? So I said, well, what resources have we got? They said, well, we haven't got any money, we haven't got any support, we haven't got an organisation. I said, okay, that's a great start. Let's get going. So we just went around the country doing the debates, because we had, that was part of the rule book, you had to do the debates, which no problem with that, and then doing rallies and mobilising people. And from that we developed a massive base, and we won with 250,000 votes 6 weeks later. And so it was about mobilising people on an alternative. Now that put me into the leadership of the party and leader of the opposition. And to be honest, I'd underestimated the degree of malevolence and opposition within the Labour Party hierarchy, not within the party members, party hierarchy. And so from day one, it was an attempt by all of them to isolate me from the basis on which we'd been elected. So it was a fascinating period. I've got my book coming out next year. I'll come again if you want me to talk about it.
That'd be great.
And so, yes, it was an isolating experience, but what it taught me was that the power of the media to frame opinion and the ability of the parliamentary system to try and curtail what you're doing, but also the huge thirst there is out there to participate in and hear something different. My whole approach was to empower and mobilise through community organising and community organisation. And I have to say, despite everything, only 18 months later from being elected, just over 18 months later, we had the 2017 general election, and we got 41% of the vote. And that was not achieved because of the British media being kind to me. I have to say 8% of the media were reasonable, 92% were hostile. So we had a good basis.
And knowing what you know about the media's capacity to frame opinion, do you have any regrets or things that you would have done differently?
I'm kind of with Frank Sinatra on this one, really. Regrets, I've got a few. But then again, too few to mention. Well, I think with hindsight, and hindsight is a very helpful tool, we should have pushed back much harder straight away against the media. We thought they would treat me as the other leaders of the opposition have been treated, at least giving you a hearing of what you're trying to say. They didn't. From day one, they did not.
On specific issues like anti-Semitism or...
Well, that
or
came later. The grotesque accusations against me came later. To begin with, it was just looking around for anything to disagree with me about. I mean, one of the most bizarre things was I was given a cup of coffee and a cake by the staff of Costa Coffee outside Westminster Abbey, outside St. Paul's, rather. The papers all ran with the story that I'd stolen food from military veterans who were left hungry because of my greed. Wow. you know, it was that level that we're dealing with. And grotesque accusations were made against me, which we pushed back against, obviously, and I find disgusting.
And you said you...
The dishonesty of some of our media in the way they frame individuals has to be challenged.
And you said that there was malevolence and opposition that existed within the ranks of the Labour Party. What specifically are you pointing to there?
Parliamentary Labour Party. I had promised that I would form a shadow cabinet and that it would be broad-based. Well, it had to be because the majority of the Parliamentary Labour Party were not supporters, but I'd promised that all along. And I did that. I promised it would be 50% women, and it was. And I'd promised that we would be as inclusive as possible of all ranges of opinion in policy making, which I tried to do. However, what I found was that from the very beginning, there were people that I'd appointed to the shadow cabinet who absolutely in front of me were sending out social media messages attacking me during shadow cabinet meetings. I could see them in front of me doing it. So I said, well, so I tried to ban phones from shadow cabinet meetings. And then all those that wanted to send out hostile messages suddenly claimed they had to have their phones with them in case their children needed to contact them during cabinet meetings, really, really. Anyway, so it was that kind of thing. We had a rebellion in December 2015, which was only 3 months after becoming leader. We then had a challenge the following summer to my leadership, which we then had another leadership election less than a year after the first one, and we won that with even more votes. Things became slightly better within the party after that, because they realised there was support for the kind of strategy that myself and others were trying to follow. But it was I'm not pretending it was an easy time, and it's very easy to also be sucked into the internals of Parliament during all that, rather than being out there campaigning on austerity, on peace, on justice, against poverty.
As you'll know, with the current political situation now, there's been quite a significant gain in some right-wing parties. So Reform made gains in the recent local elections. In the US, Trump wiped the Democrats out. We're also seeing rising support for some right-wing parties across Europe, the AfD being an example in Germany. What do you put this rise in support to right-wing parties down to?
Interesting combination of things. One is deindustrialization all across Europe. So all across Europe you see forgotten towns. You see it in northern France, you see it in eastern Germany, you see it in the former industrial parts of Spain, Netherlands, Belgium, everywhere. Without the replacement of those high-skilled jobs, the equivalent being the loss of the coal mining industry in Britain, which for all its dangers at its end was a very well-paid, highly unionised, actually relatively safe environment in which to work at the end, because of the power of the unions. So the disappearance of those industries by the sort of Reaganomics, Thatcher-Reaganomics stuff, led to high levels of unemployment and a loss of the raison d'etre of those towns. You see it all over South Wales and other places, without the equivalent high quality jobs appearing. Secondly, a lack of investment by the state in those areas, and then an appeal by the far right saying, well, actually all this is because of immigration. It's absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with immigration. It's all about the role of the state in maintaining social cohesion and employment. So the far right became very loud. The conservative forces have moved to the right to try and shore up their base. So you see the British Conservative Party trying to outbid Reform day in, day out on how extreme their views are. But this is the big problem. The socialist and social democratic forces across Europe have also moved to the right and using, in many cases, almost the same rhetoric. Ditto what Keir Starmer said last week about strangers in our country. And then that has meant there's a big gap there, which is filled temporarily by the far right. But young people in Germany do not accept the racism being offered by the AfD. Young people in other parts of Europe do not accept that racism. And I think there will be a big growth now in response to the rise of the far right, both in Britain, France, Germany, of a coherent left force in politics, which has been vacated by social democratic forces all over Europe. And I was on the Council of Europe for 5 years during the last parliament and used that opportunity to build up alliances with people, parliamentary forces on the left all over Europe, and I still work with those.
Do you find it interesting that whilst obviously you disagree with Reform's social and immigration policy, they are putting forward some economic policies that would be seen as traditionally left-wing, maybe even policies you'd support, like the renationalisation of steel and water. What do you put that down?
I put it down to smart populism by the far right. And if you listen carefully to the speeches made by Reform leadership and MPs, they describe poverty in inner-city Britain, poverty in various communities across Britain, and then very, very deftly turn this into the question of refugees and immigrants, as though there's a direct correlation between desperate people trying to get from Calais to Kent with lack of investment in Pennine towns. It's utter nonsense at one level, but it's very clever. And I listened to the Reform MPs in Parliament. They also call for public ownership of water, as I do. And in that sense, yeah, I mean, it's the only way forward is to have public ownership of basic industries and services as a way of having a basic level of employment and good quality jobs within our community. So in that sense, but their answer to stop all immigration and the answer of the government to increase deportations, well, I asked this to Yvette Cooper. I said there's more than 130,000 vacancies now in the social care sector, and you're deporting people who are working in the social care sector. Where does this leave us as a society in a few years' time? Can't we instead be proud of our diversity, proud of our multilingual, multicultural society, and recognise the huge contribution that those that have migrated this country have made to our society, not just in the recent past, but over the post-war period, and indeed much longer than that?
And you touched on it earlier, but just to bring it up again, Keir Starmer recently said that the UK risked becoming an island of strangers and insisted that we needed to take back control of our borders. He's also vowed to cut foreign aid to increase defence spending. Are you worried about the direction of the Labour Party and how would this compare to the Blair years?
I'm more than worried. I'm totally alarmed at the direction it's taking. I did not agree with Tony Blair on his foreign policy one little bit and fundamentally most of his economic policy. But under Blair, there was managed migration, and he accepted that we needed to have migration into Britain because we have an aging population and actually a falling population level, as does the whole of Europe. Starmer used the exact same words of Enoch Powell in 1968. Whether that was conscious or unconscious, I don't know. But the response amongst many people has been utterly appalled by this. Now, I represent a constituency that's adjacent to Keir Starmer's, and they're broadly similar demographically, broadly similar population makeup. People in my area utterly appalled by this. They have no problem with the diversity of their community. They have no problem with people that are making such an amazing contribution to our lives. And so when the Tories started on about this in Parliament last week and a motion they put forward, I just intervened on them and said, well, actually, when you get to a hospital, what do? Do you reject the African nurses, the Asian doctors and all that? Or do you say you don't want to be treated by anybody who's an immigrant here? Of course they don't. At that point, they suddenly realise that humanity comes first.
You've been noted for substantially disagreeing with Labour policies through the Blair years, as you say, and through the Starmer years. how, where would Labour have to go in order for you to just consider packing up and saying, actually, I've had too much of the direction that my party's been going?
Well, I'm not in the Labour Party anymore, because they removed me from membership last July and sent me a two-line email saying I've been removed from membership of the party, and then a further paragraph of another couple of lines which said, here's the number of Samaritans in case you're a bit depressed. I've been in the party for 55 years, and that's how they treated me, and many, many other people like that around the country. They need to remember, arrogance in office comes back to bite you in the end. And the Labour Party membership is much smaller now. It was 600,000 when I stepped down as leader. It's now probably well under 200,000. I don't know the exact figure. They're not publishing it, which is interesting. And the economic policy is a very mixed bag. Yes, they increased the living wage. Good. Yes, they supported the negotiated deal for rail and mail workers. Good. They brought for the workers' rights bill, which is good to a point, but never brought back proper collective bargaining by sectoral bargaining. Yet at the same time, the same government is now proposing to take $5 billion out of the DWP budget, although apparently there's some possible U-turns down the road on that. Increased defence expending, as you pointed out, going up by $13 billion a year from 27 onwards. And quite blatantly cutting foreign aid to the lowest level it's been in my lifetime. Think about why people move, why people seek asylum, why people have to leave their communities because of poverty, human rights abuses and wars. And the word peace has hardly passed the lips of either Keir Starmer, David Lammy or John Healey in all this period. I'm not saying any of it's easy, of course it isn't. But pouring arms into Israel, knowing what the consequences are in Gaza, is hardly a sensible way forward, never mind the inhumanity of what's going on as children are starving before our very eyes. So we do need a total reset about challenging poverty, injustice and inequality in our own society, and looking at the causes of the wars and stress around the world, rather than just upping the arms trade. Hence we wrote this book, The Monstrous Anger of the Guns, to expose the corrupt way in which the arms industry operates globally, in all countries.
If you could reshape Labour from the ground up, how do you think that would be done?
Making the party into a much more community-based operation isn't just an electoral machine. As an electoral machine, it can be quite effective. I know that. I was once a Labour Party organiser. I do know how to run elections and how to organise in elections. But what's missing is a communication with local communities. A community that wants a new school, wants a nursery, wants an expanded hospital, or is defending something against closure. That's where their empowerment comes. They often see the Labour Party not as their allies or their friends, but as their enemy in doing all this. And so it doesn't make life easy or comfortable for politicians in office if you've got a strong community that's making demands on you, but surely that's the very lifeblood of democracy. If we don't do that, then what are we going to do? Go looking for scapegoats like Reform do, finding another minority community to blame. That leads you in a very bad and very dangerous direction. And so on June the 7th, we've got this very big anti-austerity demonstration in London. I'll be there. I'll be there on that, because there is no way this country can be called a country at ease with itself, with the growth of billionaires, inequality, rough sleeping, unbelievable levels of poverty amongst many, and then just say everything's okay. And we then have, accompanying that, a very unpleasant trend in regulations and laws to prevent protests and demonstrations and dissent. It's a very dangerous combination.
Jeremy Corbyn, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.